Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Literacy View. We have a very special guest with us this evening. Some of you will know her. It's the wonderful, fabulous Margie Gillis, the founder of Literacy How. And so let me tell you a little bit about Margie. Margie founded Literacy How to bring knowledge to practice research to the classroom. Since it was founded, Literacy How has advanced teaching and learning by helping thousands of educators in hundreds of schools and districts to understand the science of reading and use evidence-based practices to succeed. Welcome, Margie. We're so happy to have you here with us.
Thank you.
Margie, I was just saying to you how I love your newsletter. And I would recommend everyone to go to the Literacy How website and sign up for the newsletter. And the one that caught my eye, and I shared it with Judy, was the most recent newsletter about storytelling. And it was called Storytelling, Pass It On. And I read it, and you had some handouts and resources along with that. And I thought it would be fun to just bring this topic to light, since a lot of people have been talking about oral language and how to develop listening comprehension. And of course, this all ties in. So, Margie, I'm just going to just open it up with you just telling us about storytelling and why you chose to make that the topic of your last newsletter.
Thank you for teeing that up for me. Well, you mentioned oral language. So I think that is one major impetus for us to talk about storytelling because, you know, for those of you who know the work that I and my team have done, we have taken the research and tried to make it very practical for teachers. And we have this reading wheel that has the aspects of reading that we know that are very important to teaching teachers about language and reading acquisition. And so we have the five big ideas from the National Reading Panel, but at the center, we have oral language. Now, the National Reading Panel never talked about oral language. And we all know that's super important. It's the foundation of learning to read and write. But when it wasn't mentioned, we said, oh, dear, we have to like call it out. And so it's at the core. We talk about oral language at the core. It's the foundation. And we really help teachers understand, and families too, not just teachers, but parents too, families, why it's so important for children to be immersed in language from birth, right? We may not see them until they get to us in kindergarten, but if we have an impact on young children and have, you know, opportunities to talk to families, we talk about oral language at the heart, at the core. And so when you think about that, how do little kids advance their language? They advance their language through listening, through speaking, as members of a family, extended family. And part of that is through storytelling, really. And there's lots of different aspects of storytelling, which I'm sure I'll talk about and elaborate on. But that really was the driver in getting us to think about stories and where they fit in. I will also say, and this is something I'll elaborate on too with your help and your questions, but one of my most important mentors for me in my career has been Marianne Wolfe. And Marianne Wolfe, as some of you know, talk about the deep reading brain. And so in the deep reading brain, we really have this very special place for narrative and story. And so that was an opportunity for us to weave that into. Where does that fit into the big picture of ensuring that our children have reading and writing proficiency, but it really starts at the oral language level.
Wow, you said so many interesting things, and it makes me think about what's actually going on in schools now and how that gets translated into practice, right? We know it's important, but how are we bringing this into schools? So Judy, you know, I'm wondering, as far as that language comprehension piece, what does that look like now in schools? And could you see introducing Margie's handout as something that you could use with teachers and parents?
So I have to also say, I also watched the latest webinar that you guys released about 2 months ago. And I have to say, it was actually pretty incredible. It was so practical and down to earth. And I think that it covered so many important things. And it started to make me reflect on my own life. Like in the webinar, they spoke about telling personal stories and memoirs and holding on to memories and how important that is in knowledge building. And it made me think of my grandfather. My grandfather was a Holocaust survivor, and he never really liked to tell his story because it was a very painful story. But he also knew that it was a very important story. So Steven Spielberg's producers actually came to his house in Coney Island, Brooklyn. Wow. And he never spoke to anybody about his story that much. He kind of maybe protected himself and us, but he actually recorded that story so that that story wouldn't be forgotten. I haven't shown it to my own sons yet. They're 21 and 18. I think I definitely will. But what a beautiful thing to have that story, right? It wasn't a happy story. It was a story of pain and trauma. But that's his story. And it's the story of so many people. And it's history, right? Bad or good, it's still a very important story. So I think that, you know, stories, whether they're real or not real, as the webinar talked about also, are so important. And, you know, I'm in classrooms every day and, you know, curriculum is changing now and laws are changing and so forth. And I really do hope that as everything's changing, we still do devote time to storytelling. Read alouds is one thing, but being able to like just share fun stories about experiences and our lives and so forth is so important, because I think storytelling develops so many of those literacy pillars that are so important when you think about it, right? It helps with phrasing and fluency. It shows how our voice changes when we feel different emotions. I also think that storytelling is such a big part of also having kids learn what a sentence sounds like or what a phrase sounds like. And very often, unfortunately, though, still when I walk into classrooms, sometimes I'll hear teachers asking questions and kids will be responding in one word. And I think that's such a missed opportunity to show how to respond in a complete sentence. So it's funny that this is the topic we're talking about today, because it really relates to a lot of things that we see in the classrooms. And I Absolutely. Hope that it's still prioritized, because I see, you know, so many things are coming down the pipeline. I see good things, not perfect things. And I hope we could talk to Margie a little bit more about curriculums that are coming out and what that looks like. You know, I know Margie's in Connecticut. I live in Connecticut, work in New York, but, you know, teachers are really structured in their timing of, you know, trying to cover all those pieces. And I hope that with those time constraints and teachers trying to fill those pieces, that oral language is still given the attention and love that it deserves, because it is such a critical part of the literacy, you know, pie.
Yes. You know, Margie, I did share your infographic when I promoted this. I hope you don't mind, but I took a picture of it, obviously saying that it's yours, showing the wheel with oral language at the center. So, Margie, let's get into what Judy was saying. So how does this look in the classroom? Because it's going to look very different in a home with parents sharing stories. How do teachers do it? How do they fit it in? What's the model that you would suggest for teachers out there?
Well, That's a big question because it is. No, that's it's a good question because that's the question that teachers are going to ask themselves. Like, where does this fit in? How does this fit in? Mm-hmm. Let me sort of break this into two different buckets, if you will, because we're talking about oral language on one hand and we're talking about storytelling on the other. And they're definitely related, but they're not the same thing. So let's talk about oral language first, because we're now promoting what we call oracy. And we're using the word oracy because it's a term that's used to really explain how oral language is used in classrooms, particularly to develop students' speaking and listening skills. And linked to that, their pragmatics, like how do they speak to one another? How do they converse with one another? How do they share their thoughts and ideas? How do they do that through speaking? How do they do that through listening? So this whole idea of pragmatics, the way that we use language in social contexts. And there's a great, I'll link you to that video that we often show in our workshops that demonstrates what oracy looks like in the classroom. It has to be done very intentionally by a teacher, whatever content area they're responsible for. It can happen while the kids are lining up. It can happen during lunch. I mean, it can happen throughout the day, and it should happen throughout the day. And when I say it, I mean teachers being really cognizant and intentional about how they're going to structure these opportunities for kids to interact with each other, but also having a teacher sort of facilitate that. And it's there's a lot of components to it, like discussion guidelines. What are the guidelines that teachers would post in their classrooms that are sort of like what we might have called long ago the rules of the classroom? But these classrooms pertain specifically to how do we have a conversation discussion that honors and includes everyone, that gives them opportunities to express their feelings, provides scaffolding, like we hear a lot about sentence stems or sentence starters. Judy, you mentioned the importance of answering a question in a complete sentence or speaking in complete sentences for our multilingual language learners. We need to provide scaffolds for them so that they can answer the question we ask by giving them the sentence stem, and then they give their opinion or their thought. So there's lots of components to that. And the oral language is so critically important because when we think about all the skills that are involved in getting our students to think about whatever it is we're talking about, whatever the content is, they have to, we're supporting their background knowledge development, which we know is critically important. We're supporting their use of vocabulary, so their academic vocabulary. And that has to be done very intentionally. We're supporting their ability to inference, like they have to think for themselves. The answers aren't right here. We're asking them to do a critical analysis of what it is that they're either listening to or reading. They have to, as Judy said, use proper sentence structure. So syntax and grammar are really important part of building language comprehension and oral language skills. And then last but not least, they have to understand how text is structured. So if I'm going to talk about a narrative text, I'm going to think about the narrative structure. If I'm going to think about and talk about an informational or expository text, there are different structures that I need to think about, whether it's compare, contrast, cause, effect. So all of that, it's again, it's not super complicated, but it requires a teacher to understand all the things that I just laid out. We think about Hollis Scarborough. Everybody knows Hollis Scarborough's rope, or most everyone does. And I'm thinking about the top of that rope, and I just delineated those strands associated with language comprehension that you can take right in very concretely into these oral language experiences and you can do it in math and science, social studies, ELA, English language arts. Like, it isn't a content specific type of protocol or procedure. It can be applied and should be across the day. So I know that's a whole bunch of stuff I just kind of talked about, but that's the oral language right. side.
So now storytelling.
So where does storytelling fit in? So storytelling is really interesting for me. And I have to attribute a lot of this to a woman named Mary Ellen Morrow. Some of you, both of you may have heard of her. Mary Ellen Morrow is a speech and language pathologist, worked with very seriously impacted children with language-based learning difficulties, expressive language difficulties, receptive language difficulties. And because she was so immersed in children that have difficulties understanding and expressing language, she said, you know what, I am going to think about a very concrete tool that I can give these kids to be able to talk about stories. And she started with stories for a good reason. And the reason is stories have one and only one structure that kids have to think about. And they have to think about the characters in a story. They have to think about where the characters are and or when they are there. So that's the setting. They have to think about something's going to happen in a story that we often refer to as a problem. It's not always a problem, but often it is. Mary Ellen said, that's not concrete enough. That's not relatable enough for a child. We're going to call it a kickoff, right? There's something that kicks off the story that this is her terminology, changes it from a ho-hum story. I'm not just going to talk about characters and setting. That's boring. I'm going to go, oh, something happened. And now that's my hook. That's what gets the listener to want to continue to listen. And from there, here's where she deviates from the typical story map. Instead of just doing character setting, problem, solution, how am I going to go from the problem, or what she calls the kickoff, to the solution if I don't first talk about why it's a problem? Why is that kickoff a problem or something that really triggers a response from that character? It's because I have an emotion tied to that. And we have to talk about those emotions, those feelings, because that's where we connect with characters. And Judy, you talked about your grandfather. Like, that story, what was, when he told his story and he set it up, you know, he talked about him and whoever else was included in that story. And it's very emotional, right? And where they were and why that story was a problem. Like, what was it that happened? And then closely tied to that is how did the character feel? I mean, how can we relate to that? Yeah. We can't. But because when you're telling that story, you're telling the feelings that are associated with that. And oh my goodness, what did I do when that problem happened? Like, how did I survive that? What did your grandfather do to survive that horrific situation? So, I mean, that's the extreme, right? Emotional story. But a story can be anything that is personal to us that gives the listener insight into me, the character. That's my story. Here's why it was a problem for me. It made me feel sad. It made me feel angry. It made me feel whatever the emotion is. And then from there, I go to, you know, this is what I did. Because for me, that was a problem. But I knew that I wanted to do something about it. So a story has, okay, here's the situation. Here's how I felt. Now I'm going to set about to solve, or whatever you want to say, to address, to figure out whatever it is, the solution. Like, how am I going to make things better? And here are the steps I'm going to take. And that's, again, that's how the story kind of unfolds. then to carry this theme through, you end the story in two ways. First, you say, here's how it worked out, right? And most stories don't work out simply. So that's another story, you know, that we could talk more about or not. But most stories have another episode embedded because you're trying to solve the first problem and boom, there's another kickoff that sets another episode in motion. But at the very end, you get to the resolution. Like, how did the whole thing resolve? And most importantly, how did the character feel at the end of the whole thing? Like, the character felt a certain way at the beginning when that kickoff mm-hmm. hadn't occurred. They were just having a good old time, whatever it may be. And then something happened. It usually means there was a deep emotion. And then through the solving the problem process, they get to the end, which may or may not be a better emotion. Oftentimes in stories, it is because we like happy endings, but it's not always that's not always the case. But the point is that over the course of these events, the characters' feelings and emotions change. And that's an important thing to get across to children as you go through storytelling, is that's life. I mean, you know, we could try to protect children and pretend everything is beautiful and wonderful, but we know that's not always the case. And so we want to give them experiences through these read alouds, through these storytelling experiences, and give them insight into other perspectives, other cultures, other, you know, whatever it may be. And that's where storytelling, I think, is so powerful.
So we used to call some of this story grammar, right?
Story grammar, exactly.
Story grammar. And, you know, we would have these structures, just like you're talking about, Margie, and where we would go into the characters and the layers of emotion that go with the story. Here's what's on my mind. I feel like lately we are losing narrative that in favor of expository, especially with young children. And I feel a lot of attention is being given to nonfiction, and that's okay. And that's important to build content knowledge and vocabulary, but there's great value in stories. And I don't know, I'm going to throw this out to Judy and then circle back to you, Margie. What are you seeing, Judy, in schools now? Do you feel that narrative has been marginalized at all? Stories, storytelling, read alouds, is it fitting into the ELA block, or are we really devoting way more time to knowledge building, which obviously it's important, but we don't want to lose story. I think that's really important. What are you seeing?
So I'm seeing a lot of stuff. So recently I saw kids are still writing a lot of personal narratives. I still see that a lot in the field. I see that a lot, all the time, actually. So that's that. I also remember when I was teaching in the classroom a while back, kids had a really hard time doing what Margie was just talking about, like really getting into that emotion. So many kids, in my experience, would write these details, and they were like details that didn't really add anything to the story. Mm-hmm. So I know that was something that a lot of kids struggled with. So I can't wait to see writing samples once these kids did these baseline personal narratives. It's going to be fun to look at it. But what else am I seeing? We had a question also, two questions. So in your perspective, Margie, you mentioned read alouds, but you also mentioned the art of storytelling. How much of a different impact do those two things, because they are different, right? It's different if I'm telling my own story about what happened to my son Leo when he once got a hair wrapped around his finger when he was a baby and had to go to the ER, versus reading maybe a story like The Magic Fish to my class, which I used to read all the time. How much is that different? And then the second question is, I know that a lot of the research now says we weren't wired to learn how to read. how does the wiring look in terms of oral language too? So those are my two little questions.
With storytelling. You mean with storytelling? Like why
storytelling and also oral language, you know, how natural is the speaking process for a human?
Well, we know that the brain is wired to learn to speak, right? So that is clearly demonstrated. But there's a big caveat to that. And that is you have to be immersed in language to learn language. Right. So, and that's an assumption, right? Because we know from spending time with children, and I've spent a lot of time with young children, my own, my grandchildren, and then being in preschool settings, right? Is there is a real range in terms of what children have been exposed to. We know the Hart and Risley study, there's more recent studies that have really replicated those findings to say that what children have been exposed to in terms of quantity and quality, not just the number of words, but the type of words that they're listening to and the sentence structure, like you referred to earlier, Judy, that absolutely contributes to their readiness for learning to read and write. And so, yes, they're going to acquire the language if they have exposure to it. And the more exposure, the more capable they will be of being able to remember stories, being able to ultimately express what they're hearing, use those vocabulary words. Inference is another piece. Like, inference is huge. And so if a parent, a family member, caregiver is interacting with a child and asking questions, right, about, oh, why did that boat sink in the bathtub? What do you think happened? Like, even for a three-year-old, you can ask questions that require an inference. Like, their inferencing is going to improve because you've done that. And so I guess, yes, it's natural to develop the language, and reading doesn't occur naturally. We have to rewire the brain and use those areas of the language hemisphere to develop the neurocircuitry. Yes, we know that. But I think it's important to say that we can't overemphasize the role that oral language plays in those early years. So that's one thing I think you asked about. The other thing you asked about is, did I answer that question?
Yeah, that one was great. And I like that example that you just gave of how, you know, everybody thinks inferencing is, you know, such a high level thing. And of course, it is kind of not natural to everybody. But the fact that you mentioned you can start doing that with a three-year-old or a four-year-old, that's a pretty awesome concept. The other one was about read alouds versus storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, most of the read alouds that I see and I encourage, quite honestly, in young children's classrooms, starting in preschool, because we work in a lot of preschools. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned dialogic reading, because that's just such a great way to have this, again, this conversation while you're mm-hmm. reading, instead of reading the book straight through, right? We're going to have a conversation. We're going to stop and think, my gosh, why do you think Goldilocks did that? Why did she break into the Three Bears' house? Like, that seems odd. Like, whatever those conversations are. But so that I think you want to get across as you're reading these stories is that we're telling a story. So one way you can kind of connect the two is by asking the child to retell the story. Like, okay, we just heard this story about Goldilocks and the Three Bears. And of course, we know that this is a great assessment, right? An informal, not a standardized assessment. But if you want to know if a child comprehended the story that you just read to them, you ask them to tell about it. What do you remember about the story? And like you said, Faith, the story grammar with the icons helps the child that has difficulty with, you know, it's a scaffold for them. So yeah. they hold on to this part and say, oh, Goldilocks was a little girl who was walking through the woods one day. She was super hungry and she smelled something delicious. She was, it made her even hungrier. Like, you know, really get them to understand how you're going to elaborate about the character, because that character is going to be the thread that we carry through when we retell the story about Goldilocks and the three bears. And so you can say to the child, when you go home, and Goldilocks and the three bears is just something we all know, but let's say it's a story that the child never heard before, and you really work on helping the child understand those elements of the story, and developmentally they can tell you different parts of a story, and if there's a developmental sequence of when and how they can do that over the course of their early years. But you can say, when you go home tonight, tell your brother, tell your sister, tell your friend, tell whoever, tell them about the story we just read, because storytelling is really important. And, you know, or just again, to encourage this whole idea of what is story and how does it fit in. And ultimately, you mentioned personal narrative, Judy. I mean, that's part of the Common Core State Standards, is that children should be able to write a personal narrative. I find it very hard for a lot of children to do that, right? Because they're looking for a formula and it's not so formulaic. Like, anyway, that is, you know, another matter for another day. But I guess my point is helping them understand where stories come in, and how, again, a read aloud is an author's story that they wanted to tell. And even picking an author that is known for telling their personal story. Like, a lot of authors have their stories about their personal life, and then helping kids say, well, this is how this author got started. What story would you want somebody to know about your personal life? What's something that happened to you? And get them sort of practiced in doing that on an oral level. Because we always say, if you want them to do it in writing, which is the ultimate goal, they have to first be able to produce it orally. And that's all this oral rehearsal is there for a good reason, right? It correlates very highly, not only with comprehension of language, but with written expression.
So, Margie, you mentioned being immersed in language and story. What I'm seeing, and I don't know how you feel or Judy feels, you know, I'll throw out nursery rhymes to kids and books and stories that you just assume they've heard before, and they haven't. I mean, they'll look at you if I'll mention a character, I'll make a joke and I'll mention a character's name, thinking they're going to get it because they heard it already. They haven't heard it. They're not being immersed in nursery rhymes and stories and, you know, storytelling, at least from my perspective. I don't know if you're seeing something that's different from what I'm seeing. But like I said before, I feel like we're losing this very important piece. Maybe that's what caught my eye, Margie, when I saw your newsletter. Because I felt like this is a missing piece. It's like the secret sauce, and it's just not being shared in schools. So how do we get kids immersed in this? Is it part of the ELA block? Is it something that we do, like parent training on? I know when I was a project manager for Early Reading First, we did this with the teachers. We did it with parents. I mentioned dialogic reading before, which is really that serve and return, right? That, you know, the Harvard study talks about, where you're throwing out prompts and the kids are responding and you're extending language. I think there needs to be some real major training on this, because I don't see these kids immersed in language, not enough. Your thoughts?
No, I couldn't agree more. I could not agree more. I think, unfortunately, They're immersed in technology.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So yep. If you're immersed in technology, and, you know, we all get it. We understand, you know, if a parent, you know, a caregiver has a lot of things on their plate, it's so easy to hand the phone to the child. And we've all seen it in restaurants and, you know, in any number of venues. And it hurts me. It hurts
me too.
Yeah, because you can't learn pragmatics through technology, and children are lacking those skills. You can't learn, you know, the joy of you know, conversation, of building relationships. And there's interesting research about even the stories. A lot of what I see, and it makes me very sad, is early childhood educators putting on the smart boards the read aloud. So they go to the YouTube channel, they pull up a story being read over the, you know, YouTube, and they figure that's great. It's entertaining. The person reading a story could be the author. Oftentimes they're actors and actresses, whatever. And they're reading the story with great, you know, intonation, and they make the story come alive, and they're doing it way better than we are. So why not? But guess what? They've done research with fMRIs, and they've seen less activation in the child's brains when they're watching a video because it's flat.
Right.
There's no, you can't pick up affect. You can't teach body language and all the things that we know matter. So I think we have to really think about that when we do professional development for teachers, and including early childhood educators who unfortunately don't get a lot of good professional development. Mm-hmm. I think this is a message. And whenever I talk to families, I say it loud and clear. Please, please, you know, interact with your child, you know, face to face. Talk to them, you know, if I also am very sensitive to giving this message to parents. And this is, again, where storytelling comes into play. If you are not literate, you know, yourself, can you still have an impact? And we all know absolutely you can. And one of the best things you can do is tell your stories. You don't have to have the book to tell the story. You tell your story. And children love hearing your story. They want to hear it. They want to hear the story over and over and over again. And you put in new twists. Oh, here's the next episode. That last episode, I didn't tell you what happened this time. And now I'm going to tell you the second chapter of this adventure that happened to me. You know, and you have, I mean, I think you have to teach the art of storytelling. I think it helps to explain like this narrative structure that you know is called story grammar. We don't have to call it that for families, but here are the things, the elements that are really important to talk about and why. Like, I think we have to really drive home this idea of building empathy. In fact, I earmarked a quote from Marianne Wolfe's Read or Come Home, which, you know, is one of my all-time favorite books. Mm-hmm. And she writes, because I mentioned deep reading.
Yes.
She said, deep reading is always about connection, connecting what we know to what we read to what we feel to what we think, and how we think to how we live out our lives in a connected world. Like, that is a mouthful when you think about that whole idea of connection and how all of those pieces that she enumerates, right? What we know, what we read, what we feel, what we think, and how we live out our lives. Like, if we were doing that more substantively as a culture, right? And really relating to one another in these ways, you know, we would be in a whole different place right now. But the substitute would be this deep reading. Like Marianne Wolfe talks about, you know, why it's so important that we read books versus print, I mean, sorry, versus digital reading, like print, really feeling the book. You know, you see my underline, my annotate. Like, you can't do that with a digital copy. Now, there's a place for that, of course, but the point I think she makes over and over again is we have to keep fighting for getting our kids incentivized to read. And again, I think that we do that starting with the young children with oral language, and then saying, we're going to tell our story, and then we're going to write our story. And we're going to read a really interesting story, and finding out what they're interested in reading. Like, motivation is super important. So what excites them, what interests them, and pulling that in, so that there's ways to ensure that we grab them. And once, we all know this, I'm sure you both are avid readers as I am. Once you become a reader, you're like hooked. You can't get enough of it because it's so exciting. You know, you go places that you can't go otherwise. Anyway, so I know I'm rambling a little bit.
No, you're fascinating. I'm listening, and I'm nodding my head in agreement. So Judy, you and I said that we were going to ask Margie about small group reading. If you remember, Judy and I were talking how lots of schools now are getting rid of TC, or at least talking about the TC reading and writing project work. There is a shift that's going on.
And there's also a big shift away from guided reading now. Yes. Well, so schools are no more guided reading also.
Right. So the question is, Margie, what will they be doing in small group? Mm-hmm. And could some of this work that you're talking about be small group work, doing this when you pull a group of children? So if you have a group, I mean, what I'm thinking is there's a group with low language skills. Could this be small group work? Because that's what teachers want to know now. If we're getting rid of this TC model, and not that it's happening so fast, you know, but people are talking about it. What are they replacing that with? They want to know what's happening. You know,
for a lot of the lower level kids, we're replacing stuff with decodable text, but there's also kids that have other issues kids that are strong in comprehension, and we want to take the work further. What does that look like? I think for a lot of people, they're very used to scripts. And if they don't have a script, they don't know. Like, Faith knows what to do. When I asked Faith, what are you going to do? She knows what she's going to do, but not everybody knows what they're going to do. So, yeah, that's an interesting
one. You have to have a lot of knowledge to be able to sort of respond in the moment and figure out how you're going to differentiate for these different. You're talking specifically about different language levels. And I mean, I do think that the small group instruction is extremely important, and thinking about what does that look like for what purpose. And I always come back to what's the objective. We usually think of the small group instruction differentiated by skill level. So those foundational skills, because they're so much easier to assess, and you figure out pretty quickly what decoding skills kids need, what encoding skills they need, and you can put them in groups according to those levels. It's not as easy to do it for language, I don't think. So I think that's your question and your point. I think that one of the ways that I've seen it done effectively is, let's say you have, going back to the read aloud, since that's something we've talked a lot about this evening, and you're reading a story to the whole class, and you want the kids to do something, you know, after they've done the read aloud, after you've had this dialogic reading, et cetera. I think the follow-up for something like that could be in a small group, and you specifically talked about the kids that have limited expressive language skills, and bringing them into a group and thinking about what that follow-up would look like as compared to a group that could potentially write the next chapter of the story or complete a more robust kind of follow-up activity based on what you just talked about, or fill out a graphic organizer with the elements of the story. Mm-hmm. And so there's different things that I think you can do based on the language levels of the student, where you would probably want somebody, the teacher, to push into the small group that has the children that really need explicit instruction and somebody modeling the language and making sure that the kids are practicing those language skills with a model and opportunities to practice. Whereas, you know, the students that have more advanced skills wouldn't necessarily need that same level of scaffolding or facilitation. So, I mean, that's one thing that comes to mind.
Mm-hmm. Can I jump in?
Sure, please do.
All right. So something came to my mind. So oral language is very important. And I'm seeing with a lot of the new curriculums that are rolling out, a lot of the tasks after, you know, the lesson are oral discussions. But I know that a lot of principals in general, you know, citywide, statewide, countrywide, like artifacts. So because they want to see tangible proof. And writing is a very different skill than listening and being able to tell something. So that's another whole story, because sometimes teachers will expect kids to go write and they don't know how to write a response. So that's a whole different issue. But like, so if kids are giving responses, how do we have quote unquote artifacts for somebody to know whether the kids got the concept or the skill or, you know, the teaching point or not?
Yeah. So I'm going to add on to what Judy was saying, because I think Judy and I were thinking exactly the same thing. So that really, I know that doesn't happen a lot, but
I'm bullshit on you, Faith.
All right, I got the BS button. So,
but Margie didn't. You did.
So I was thinking about assessing oral language. So like Judy mentioned, artifacts. In schools, they want hard evidence for everything. They want a record of something. So how do you do this?
A checklist,
right? Like, so, you know, I know you mentioned an informal assessment could be retell. And I completely agree with you with the retell. You know, we had an episode about this with Dibbles and how some people don't do the retell portion of this and how important retell is. And again, that's another story. But jumping on what Judy said with artifacts, assessing proof, could you elaborate on that, Margie?
Yeah, I think it's hard to do. So that's what you're kind of... Mm-hmm. That's what you're speaking to. And
yes.
I heartily agree with that. It's really hard to do. It's easy to say we need an artifact. We need some accountability to know that the kids stayed on task during this small group instruction, because that's our progress monitoring. That's mm-hmm. how we know, did they get it, you know, and are we ready to go to the next step? I think the thing about language comprehension that distinguishes it from word recognition work is that word recognition skills are constrained skills that are by nature progressive, follow a scope and sequence, right?
Yeah.
And finite. So you kind of have, if you have a scope and sequence, which we know everyone should, if they're teaching those word recognition, those discrete skills, then you know when they get here, you know, they've mastered this step, they go to this one, this one, this one. It doesn't work that way with comprehension, right? We don't have a scope and sequence for that. So then the question is, how are we going to, what's our benchmark? What's our evidence that they're ready to go to the next step? And the truth of the matter is, we don't really have any good tools for that, other than like I said, you can have a graphic organizer. I think that's one way to do it. I think exit tickets where you ask them to respond with just a simple sentence. If they can't do a complete sentence, you give them a sentence stem and they have to finish it. Mm-hmm. Did they get the gist? You know, like it all depends on where they are in their language comprehension understanding and what your goals are for that particular group. Because again, it comes back to what's your objective for this small group. They're multilingual language learners. They have limited experience with English. We're getting them to have a subject and a predicate when they respond to a question. It doesn't have to be elaborated. We're happy if they could just put the who with the do and get the gist of what a sentence has to have in it, that kind of thing. And that is, that hopefully will guide our artifact, whether or not the child is successful with that particular task. And I think you have to, for those students in those groups that really require a lot of explicit instruction, we have to say to them up front, we have to first ourselves as teachers know what the objective is, but we also have to articulate that for the kids. Like, this is what we're going to do now. Here's the follow-up activity. Here's what you're going to do. Here's what I'm going to look for. What are we doing? Can you explain in your own words what I'm going to be looking for? Like getting them to restate what it is that they're being asked to do. What's the artifact going to look like? And ultimately be critiquing their own work when you kind of collect that artifact and say, tell me about this. In case you're having a hard time interpreting what it is that they said or did. So, and eliciting language from them as they're kind of giving you evidence, presenting evidence for whether or not they were able to carry out the task. I'm just kind of making it up as I go, but that's just what I'm thinking
that's
about.
Exactly what Peyton and I do.
Pardon?
That's what I would call the literacy view. We just, there's no BS. We just go off the cuff, whatever.
Well, we all have a lot of background in this, so I'm not completely making it up, but I'm trying to imagine, because unfortunately I'm not in the classroom. I spend a lot of time with mentors who spend a lot of time in classrooms. So I'm just sort of channeling them and their experiences in classrooms and my own past experiences.
Well, can I ask another question? I know I've been asking a lot.
Judy. Just remember,
I have to do it. Balanced literacy, oral language and balanced literacy versus SOR. How does it look different?
That's a really interesting question.
I had to do it. That's it, Faith. That's my final one. I promise.
That's it. You're not getting any more.
it's an interesting question because I would think, balanced literacy's predecessor, if you will, was whole language, right?
Yeah.
And I came into education just prior to whole language coming on the scene. And you would think whole language, right? It's like language is in the title of that, is in the name. Whole, we're talking about language as a whole, right? Holistically. So you would think that oral language would be front and center in that. And I think in whole language, the idea was we're going to immerse children in authentic literature that is rich language, right? And so what did balanced literacy add or delete from that? I think that the whole idea of changing the term, because it's similar, right? Whole language and balanced literacy are not exactly the same, but there's certainly a lot of similarities there, was this idea that we were pitting comprehension and phonics against one another. So we're going to balance it out by bringing the two together. And to be honest with you, I feel like balanced literacy left some of the good things about whole language behind in trying to find the balance mm-hmm. between those two. Because honestly, I think what was good about whole language was this idea of giving kids exposure to rich language mm-hmm. through rich texts, through reading great books to kids and mm-hmm. with kids. And not that balanced literacy would say, oh yeah, we believe in that too. But I don't know that the focus was on that. The focus was more on, more of a embedded approach to teaching skills versus very explicit. If you don't call it out and recognize the importance, you're going to leave a lot to chance. And we know what happens when you do that. So I guess here's what I would say. Balanced literacy does not acknowledge the centrality of language in literacy learning. Like, it does not acknowledge that language has a structure and that structure should inform reading and writing instruction. So that means that teachers have to know the phonology, that they have to know the orthography, they have to know semantics. That to me was a missing piece. Not that it was in whole language either, it wasn't. But we went even further astray, I think, with balanced literacy. Whereas structured literacy, which is a term I use in lieu of science of reading is a body of research. Structured literacy, it's called structured because it is all about teaching the structure of language and its relationship to those big ideas that the National Reading Panel recognized were really important.
So, Mars, did we leave anything out that you would like to add? I know I told you we would stick to an hour and we could talk to you forever because you're just so interesting. But is there anything we didn't ask you that you would like to mention?
No, you asked me. I mean, I took notes here. I think, just things that I wanted to cover this evening. And I think I hit on the things that were important from my perspective. And you asked great, great questions that went beyond what my notes, what I wanted to highlight. So, no, I love the questions. I mean, I like having a conversation. Much rather do this than stand on a podium for an hour and a half and try to engage an audience that may not want to be there. So this was a lot of fun.
Well, it was such a pleasure having you, Margie. You are just a font of knowledge and just a delightful person to speak with. So we are so honored that you joined us. I know September is a busy month in schools and you took the time to be with us and we so appreciate it. Thank you so much. And thank you, listeners, for joining us. Judy, just share how people could get in touch with us. I know you always close with that, so go ahead, hit it.
All right, nothing else from me except follow me on Twitter at BoxNerdJudy. Follow beautiful Faith at Faith Borkowski. Follow us on Instagram at BoxNerdDamsky. Follow Faith at High Five Literacy. And then the name of our Facebook group, the Literacy View, Real Teachers Letting Loose. Did I say it right, Faith?
Yes, it's the Literacy View, Real Teachers Letting Loose.
And join our
Real Teachers.
And follow us also. We're on YouTube, the Literacy View. Subscribe to our channel. And also you can find us on all Apple Podcasts, Spotify. We're all over the place.
Yay.
Okay. And we're going to put the links to Margie's work, anything she shared with us will be shared with you. So thank you again.
Thank you all.